Last week, we talked about the obligation to daven, to say the Amidah three times a day. And we saw, contrary to what many people may have heard in the past, that from the beginning of rabbinic literature all the way up until the 1600s, there is no hint in any text that there's any gendered difference with regard to obligation in davening. That is to say, from the Mishnah, through the Talmud, through the medievals, Rashi, Rambam, Ramban, and up to and including the Shulchan Aruch, the only things that ever get stated are that women are obligated in prayer just like men. There's disagreement about why that is, but there is no disagreement about the fact that that is the case. Only when you get to the 1600s do we get the Magen Avraham, who looks around at the world around him and says, well, in fact, in my community, women are not davening regularly. I assume that they are not sinners, so I must find a way to justify their practice. He looks at the Rambam's framework and says, if I use this framework, I can construct an argument, albeit not a very good one, both because it is not what the Rambam himself says, which the Magen Avraham admits, and because it relies on the Rambam, who is the minority view in the first place. But I can construct an argument to justify the practice of what's happening around me. Some later authors pick up on that. For the most part, in fact, they do not. The Mishnah Berurah states straightforwardly that women are obligated to daven at least Shacharit and Mincha, even though he's willing to allow a little bit of leniency for the evening prayer. But other authorities say differently from that as well. So we ended last week with a clear position that if we're looking at sort of what the basic outline of the sources say, gender is not relevant to obligation in prayer, to obligation in tefillah. One could construct an argument to justify the fact that in many communities, women were not davening, but that is not a straightforward reading of the classical sources. Today, we're going to turn our attention to prayer with a minyan. Right? We talked last week about the obligation to pray at all. You will sometimes hear folks say, okay, we will grant that in fact, the straightforward reading of the sources has women and men, and I would add folks of all genders, equally obligated in prayer. That cannot be the reason why historically women were excluded from positions of leadership and counting in a minyan, but perhaps women are exempt from praying with a minyan, and that would be the reason they cannot lead or count in a minyan. So we're going to turn our attention to that. Before we even look at any sources, it's just to sort of set up the outline for what we've been looking at today. We're going to be asking fundamentally three questions about prayer with a community. Tefillah b'tzibur. I'll start using that phrase now. Hopefully that'll be clear. Tefillah b'tzibur, the idea that one has to pray with a minyan, with a group of 10 adult halakhic Jews. And we'll ask three questions about that. First of all, is there an obligation in tefillah b'tzibur? Is anyone, irrespective of gender, obligated to pray with a minyan? Or is your only obligation really to daven? And if you daven with a minyan, harei meshubach. That's a very nice thing to do, but it is not actually a requirement. That's the first question. The second question would be, to the extent that there is an obligation to daven with a minyan, why? Why would the sources require you not only to pray three times a day, but at least where possible to do that with other Jews? And finally, do any of those reasons suggest that the obligation in prayer with a minyan should be gendered? So those are sort of three guiding questions we'll be thinking about as we work through the sources today. We'll start off with source number one, a passage from the Talmud, from Bavli Brachot. It's a long source with a bunch of different ideas in it, but they're all going to be relevant to what we are talking about today. So we begin with a story that I think is meant to be humorous, but also tells us quite a lot about tefillah b'tzibur. Amar le Rabbi Yitzchak le Rav Nachman. Rav Yitzchak said to Rav Nachman, "My time alo asi mar le beiknish de litzluye. Why didn't you come, presumably yesterday, to synagogue to pray?" So Rav Nachman says back, "Amarle, lo yachilna, I couldn't. I had some kind of conflict that did not allow me to get to synagogue for davening." Amarle, so Rabbi Yitzchak says back to Rav Nachman, "Lich nefei lamar asara velitzle. If you couldn't make it to shul to daven, you should gather 10 people and pray with a minyan in your home since you couldn't make it to synagogue." Amarle, Rav Nachman says back to him, "Trichli milsa, that would be very annoying to have to make a minyan at your home every time you're going to daven. If you can't get to shul, you have to find 9 other adult halakhic Jews to make a minyan. That would be very annoying." So Rabbi Yitzchak says back to him, "Volema le mar lishluka de tzibura, v'idana de mitzali tzibura, leisi velo de lamar." So Rabbi Yitzchak says to Rabbi Nachman, "Well, then at least you should have told the congregational agent," which normally this phrase means the chazan. Here it clearly does not mean that. but the gabbai or some figure in the synagogue should come to your house and let you know when the community is davening, so you can at least daven at the same time as the community. Amar le, sort of Nachman says back to him, Maikule hai, literally, why so much? Why do I have to go to such lengths to daven at the same time as the community? I'm just gonna daven. Amar le, to Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Rabbi Yochai says back, well, we have this statement that comes fundamentally from Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the Rashbi, an important figure in Mishnaic times. My dichsiv ani sefila si lacha eis Hashem, Hashem eis ratzon. What is the meaning of the verse that says, it's actually hard to translate literally, but something like, as for me, my prayer is to you, God, at a time of desiredness, at a time of ratzon, right? What does that verse mean? Amos I eis ratzon. When is the time when God has desire? Bishash et sibur mis palalim. When the community is praying. So the idea seems to be that when the community is praying, that is when God is the most desiring of prayer. And so if you want your prayer to be accepted by God, for God to want your prayer, then you want to pray at a time when the community is praying. And so ideally, you would go to synagogue and pray with the community. But if you can't do that, at least you would pray at the same time that your community is praying. Rabbi Acha bar Rabbi Hanina Amar Mehacha. Rabbi Acha bar Rabbi Hanina says, I get the same idea, but not from that verse, not from Bani Sefilasi, but rather from a different verse, a verse from Job. Hein el kabir velo yimas. Indeed, God is great and is not contemptuous, which, as many of the verses in Job, is a very hard verse to actually translate. This one's actually a little bit easier than others. But I want to point out one important thing that you'll need to know to understand what Rabbi Acha is doing here, which is that kabir, the language that is translated here as God is great, could be understood to mean the many, right? If something is great, it might be great because there's a lot of folks there. And so it seems like what Rabbi Acha bar Rabbi Hanina is doing here is saying, not Hein El Kabir Velo Yimas, not that God is great and will not be contemptuous, but rather El Kabir Velo Yimas. God will not reject that of the many. God will not reject the prayer of the many. I'm going to skip the second verse here because it's a little complicated how it relates to this one, but it gets across the same idea. So in other words, we have this idea that if you pray when lots of Jews are praying, God is more likely to accept your prayer than if you pray on your own. Excuse me to the last paragraph here on this page. Tanya Nami Hachi, we have a Tannaitic source, a source in the same time period as the Mishnah, which gets across the same idea. Rabbi Nasan Omer, Minayin She'en HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moetz B'Tfilas San Shel Rabim. Where do we get this idea that God does not reject the prayer of the many? Shneamar, Hein El Kabir Velo Yimas, the same verse. So we get a number of sources that get this, across this idea that if you want your prayer to have the best chance of being accepted by God, you should pray with or at least at the same time as others. Keep going and we'll talk about the source when we get to the end. So we're now on page 2. Amar Reish Lakish, Kol Mishi Yesh Lo Beis HaKnesses Be'iro, Ve'eno Nichnas Sham Lis Palel. Anyone who lives in a city where there is a synagogue and you don't go to that synagogue to pray, Nikra Shachein Ra, you are called a bad neighbor. V'lo od el shagorim galas lo ulavana. And not only are you called a bad neighbor, but you cause exile for yourself and for your children. If there's a shul where you live and you don't go there to daven, you are essentially causing exile for yourself and your family. V'yamar Abaye, and Abaye said, Mareish hava garisna bego besa umatlina beveikinishta. Initially, I would learn Torah at home, and I'd go to synagogue to pray, to daven. Kevan de shamana lahad amar bichia bar ami bishmei de Ula. Once I heard the following statement, which was said in the name of Ula, what was the statement? Miyom shachar of besa mikdash. Einu lakash baruchu ba'olamo ela arba amos olacha bilvad. Since the temple was destroyed, where does God dwell? When the temple existed, God's concentrated dwelling place on earth was in the temple. Where does God dwell now? In the four cubits of halacha. Now that I've heard that statement, lo hava matzlina ela hechad garisna. Now that I've heard that, I don't go to synagogue to pray anymore. I pray where I learn, because where I learn is where God dwells. And so if I want my prayer to ascend to God most directly, then I should learn not in the synagogue, but in this case of Abaye, at home where he's learning. Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi, Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi, two figures who always appear together as chavrusa partners, even though there were 13 synagogues in Tiberias where they lived, lo matzlu ela beni amude. They would only pray between the pillars, which seems to me, between the pillars, heicha dehavu garse, between the pillars where they studied. That is to say, they did not go to synagogue to pray, but rather they would learn all day at home with each other. And when it came time to daven, they would just get up where they were, pray, and then go back to their learning.
Does this say nothing about the strength of the prayer? I mean, we are used to the idea that if it's a minyan, your prayer are most likely to be heard. And it's not here, this idea, right?
So that idea, I think, is here, right? The idea that your prayer is most likely to be heard, it doesn't get stated explicitly that way. I was sort of interpreting it that. But I think it's a straightforward interpretation of your. It's a time of ratzon, of God desiring prayers when the community is praying. And therefore, your prayer is most likely to be heard when you're praying with a minyan.
Because of the timing.
Because of the timing, although it does seem like it's even better, not just the timing, but also the physical location, right? Better to pray with a minyan, but at least pray at the same time as the minyan.
Which is what we are struggling with during the time of COVID, right?
Definitely. Definitely. Right. Thank you.
The part about the effect of COVID, of praying at the same time, and I've written a piece about this for a project on Jewish life during the pandemic and about the halakha. And I don't remember this particular reference, but it seemed to fit in with the idea that by praying virtually, whether on live stream or more of significance over Zoom, that you're nonetheless fulfilling the obligation and praying with the community. And I noticed even when, at least at my shul, when we went back to partially in person, that for a time we still counted people who zoomed in as of fulfilling the obligation that way.
Great. So it's actually interesting. This is the first time I've taught this material since the start of COVID, I think. And so I hadn't thought about that, but I think it's right that both Andrea and Susan go there. These are sources that are very relevant to that question. There's a different question here that I don't want to get into for the sake of time, which is, you know, if you're davening on a live stream or on Zoom, are you in the room with that minyan or is something else happening there? That's an important question that is going to take us too far afield. But minimally for these sources, what we're saying is there's some value of tefillah b'tzibur that is accomplished, even if you're not on the live stream for that matter, right? Even if you are simply, you know that your synagogue prays every Shabbos morning at 9 a.m. and you know that they get to the Amidah usually at 9:45. So to make sure that you're davening the Amidah at 9:45 a.m. when your community is, would accomplish something. Does it accomplish everything? It would seem like no, but not totally clear, but it definitely accomplishes something.
Seems like you should pray with the people that you learn with.
Great. So there's value not only in having a minyan, but also in the people you learn with. And also I would add to that, Rhonda, the place where you learn, right? There's something that happens. You know, I am blessed to teach in yeshiva, where at least for much of the year, I get to pray at the same seat where I sit and prepare my shiurim and learn my Torah. And there's something powerful about that. You know, there's also, we'll talk about this in a little bit, there's also something powerful about the location of where we learn. One powerful location is where you learn. Another powerful location might be the synagogue. So we'll come back to that in a minute. So we've got minyan, we've got timing, we've got place and people, not just the number of people, but the specific people.
Okay, it seems a little contradictory. I'm not sure, you know, the last part, because Abaye says, I would learn in the house and daven in synagogues. And then he says, I would daven in where I learned. So is he davening alone or is he learning with people? It's not really clear, and it almost seems like a contradiction to the first part where you know, there's this emphasis on why didn't you come to the synagogue and why didn't you try to get 10 people together, and now he's saying he'll just interrupt his learning, daven, and go right back to it. Is he doing it at the same time as the congregation, inviting people in? None of that is really clear here.
None of it's clear, but if I asked you, Lynn, that you had to make a $5 bet one way or another what it means, what would you say?
I would have to assume from the rest of this section that he's probably learning in a group and they would all daven together, but
okay.
There's really nothing here to indicate that.
Beautiful.
That's actually the case.
So either I've got an internal contradiction here, or Abaye, and for that matter, Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, the story about them, there's not enough information here, right? Either they're gathering 10, which is, it's weird that the source doesn't say that then, right? Abaye didn't say, I started making a minyan at my home. No, he says, I started davening at home. So the truth is, my read here, and this is, you know, I think typical of how Talmud often works, is that we do have a kind of internal contradiction here, right? We begin with all these stories about how valuable it is to pray with a minyan, and then we get these rabbis, major sages, Abaye, Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi. These are A-listers in the Talmud. These are not minor characters. And they are fundamentally saying that, yeah, I mean, it's nice to daven with a minyan. Abaye makes that clear by saying, I used to daven in a synagogue. And Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi were told, even though they had 13 synagogues, which makes it seem like you would, there's value to davening in the synagogue, but nonetheless, there are other things that might override that. If that's the case, it doesn't seem like what we're talking about is a sort of formal obligation, right? In fact, there's no language here of, you know, a person must pray with a minyan. Rather saying, well, there's something, if you're praying, well, you want your prayer to be received. And your prayer is most likely to be received when you are with a minyan. That doesn't mean that if you don't pray with a minyan, your prayer is invaluable is a funny word. It means the opposite of what I thought it meant. Right? It doesn't mean your prayer is valueless, but it means it's less likely, it's less reliably going to be heard by God. So of course, if you care about prayer, if you take the time to pray, you'd want to go out of your way to try to pray with a minyan if you can. It doesn't mean that prayer without a minyan is not fulfilling a fundamental obligation. So I think that that contradiction that Lynn is sort of picking up on sort of highlights the idea that what we're talking about here seems to be what we'd call a maila ba'alma, right? Sort of and you'll see this phrase later in the sources, a sort of improvement, an adornment of an obligation, but not an obligation in its own right. It, to the extent that it is an obligation, presumably it's because it's the way to make your prayer most received. And therefore, I would think that anyone who's obligated to pray would be obligated to pray with a minyan, right? Because if I'm obligated to pray, then I want my prayer to be as positive as possible.
I think I didn't bring this up before because it didn't relate to the central question of gender. But it seems to me there's a contradiction between two values, the values of tefillah and the values of Talmud Torah.
Yeah,
and that Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi are of the opinion that Torah study is, God is going to listen to my prayers more if I am studying Torah than if I am with a minyan. Might be a touch of elitism in here too, but we have that when we take the Torah out in shul, we have special personal prayers because when you're studying Torah, that's when God is going to be traditionally more likely to listen to your prayers. So they say, why do I need both? God's going to listen to my prayers mostly if I am studying Torah. And of course, if you can introduce Torah study into the synagogue, then you have both. But
that's
a contradiction in values and perhaps a touch of elitism among the Torah scholars.
Yeah, I mean, I smiled when you said a touch of elitism, because I think that's probably true. And I think we also understand this, if we flip our perspective, not from a theological one, but to a psychological one. You know, when I'm learning, if I'm actually learning and not just like studying for a test, I'm actually learning Torah because I'm trying to be the person God wants me to be in the world. Well, then that puts me in a mindset where I'm more likely to daven with proper intention. And so I think for anyone, like that could be a valuable trait. Okay. So source number two, another passage from the Talmud. Ma'aseh Rabbi Eliezer shenichnas lebeis haknesses velo matza asara. So it once happened that Rabbi Eliezer went into synagogue and there were not 10 there. V'shichrer avdo v'shlimo liasara. So he freed his slave. This is a non-Jewish slave. There are all sorts of things that are troubling about this, not least of which is major sages owning slaves. We can't go down that road for the sake of time, but we also have to acknowledge that this is disturbing, to say the least. Also problematic, if not disturbing, is the rabbinic idea that when one frees a Gentile slave, it is a kind of conversion process, and they are now considered a fully legally invested Jew. So you can't come out of slavery without becoming a Jew, for better and for worse. So Rabbi Eliezer frees his slave, who now becomes a Jew, and as a result, you now have a minyan in synagogue. V'hechi avid hachi, how can you do such a thing? V'ha'amar Rav Yehuda, didn't the later Rabbi Rav Yehuda say, kol ha'mishachrer avdo over ba'aseh, anyone who frees their Gentile slave has violated a positive commandment, speaking of disturbing, This is even more disturbing. We could do a whole course on this, but we're not going to right now. Shenamar, Leolam Behem Tavodu, as it says, they shall always serve you. Again, this is deeply disturbing. There are ways to think about this that would make sense to us, but we're not going to go down that route right now. The core question here is, how could Rabbi Eliezer do this? He's freeing his slave, which we're going to take for granted you're not allowed to do in order to make a minion. How could you violate a commandment in order to fulfill some other commandment? Says the, how can you violate this commandment, I should say? To which the Talmud responds, Lidvar mitzvah shani. For a mitzvah, it's different. You're allowed to do this in order to fulfill the mitzvah. What mitzvah? Presumably something about communal prayer, that you need the minyan for that. To which the Talmud responds, mitzvah ba'aveirahi. That's no good, because that is a mitzvah that's fulfilled through a violation. If I, Yudit, you're on the top of my screen, so you'll be my example right now. If I steal Yudit's lulav and then shake that lulav on Sukkos, that is not a valid mitzvah, because it's a mitzvah that came by way of transgression. So how could Rabbi Eliezer free a slave to make a minyan? That's a mitzvah that comes by way of transgression. To which the Talmud responds, mitzvah derabim shane. A mitzvah that, well, you know, the translation doesn't translate that phrase. A mitzvah derabim is different. Literally, a mitzvah of the many. The Amar of Yeshua ben Levi, Leolam yashkim adam beisik nesis kadeshi yizke v'yimne imasara rishonim. A person should always get to synagogue early in order to be worthy and to be counted among the first 10. So that last bit is not really relevant to what came before. It's just a sort of phrasing of being one of the first 10. Although it's sort of ideologically relevant, even if it's not technically relevant. The question here is, what does mitzvah derabim mean? Right? And there are two ways you could understand this. You could understand this as, well, I can't fulfill the mitzvah of lulav by stealing Yudit's lulav, because I'm one person filling that mitzvah, and so my theft does not override the value of my fulfilling the mitzvah. But maybe you would say, if my stealing Yudit's lulav allows me to give that lulav to 100 Jews who will then take lulav, that would be okay, because many people are fulfilling a mitzvah then. And so in that case, I could fulfill the mitzvah of many through a transgression. That's a possible read, though I don't think it's a very strong read, to be honest. I don't think we would ever say that fulfilling 100 people's obligation lulav would be okay based on my stealing Yudit's lulav. The other possibility, which I think is more likely, that we're saying here is that not that there is a mitzvah on Yehudit and Lynn and Rhonda, who all happen to be the top three people on my screen, not that each of those people individually has an obligation to pray with a minyan, but rather there is such a thing as a communal obligation, right? Not an obligation that Yehudit has, but rather an obligation that the Jewish community of Riverdale, where I live, or of Washington, D.C., where some of you might live, or wherever it may be, that those Jewish communities have an obligation to have communal prayer. And that, not the sort of obligation of each individual to do this, but the community's obligation can, in fact, override a local transgression. That seems to be the more likely read here. That's going to be a very important concept, not only today, but as we continue the next couple of weeks. This idea of individual obligations versus communal ones is going to come up again and again. So from this passage, it would seem like there is a value in communal prayer. It is plausible that what we're saying is that each individual has an obligation in communal prayer, and that's why Rabbi Eliezer freed his slave, even though that lichora, on the face of it, is a violation of halacha. But more likely, it means that there's an obligation on communities that is significant, but not that each individual has an obligation to pray with the community. Okay, so now we're looking at a passage that is not from Brachot. It is not on its face about prayer from Sachim. It is a very obscure passage. It's not clear what it means. We'll have to look at two different interpretations to think about this. So, Amar Rabbi Abahu, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. So Reish Lakish says, Legabal v'lisfila u'lemtilas yadayim, for kneading and for prayer and for washing of hands, arba milin, four meal, which, although I've been told, I've never looked this up, but I've been told this is a coincidence that it sounds like the word mile. It is basically equivalent to a mile. It's the amount you could walk in 18 minutes. And at least, you know, I've always been told 20 minutes is a normal walking pace for a mile. So for kneading, for prayer, and for washing hands, four meal. Very obscure what this means. Let's take a look at two different interpretations of this. The first one from Rabbeinu Hananel. He was sort of Rashi before Rashi. he fell out of favor when Rashi's commentary came into being, because Rashi's commentary sort of took the world by storm, but still a very important and early commentator. He says, "V'latfila," right, for prayer, "kegon shetzarich lispalel, v'yesh lefanav mayim litol yadav," right? For example, it's come time to pray, and you've got, you're traveling, you're on the path. I should have said, that's the context here, is that we're talking about a traveler. You're traveling, and if you keep going for up to four miles, you'll find water with which to wash your hands. Many people, especially in non-Haredi communities, are not careful about this, but really you're supposed to wash your hands before you pray. Like the same way you wash before eating bread, you're supposed to wash your hands before you pray. Many synagogues will have a washing station right outside the sanctuary for folks to be able to do that. But what if I'm traveling? I don't have water, and it's time to say mincha, let's say. Well, if I can go 4 mil and find water to wash my hands, then I have to keep going up to 4 mil. And so too, if it's time to pray or I want to eat bread and I need to wash my hands to eat bread, if I can find water within the next 4 mil, I got to keep going. So what does it mean for tefillah? So according to Rabbi Yochananel, it means that if I can find water to wash before davening, then I got to go up to 4 mil in order to wash my hands. What matters more for our purposes is that Rashi understands this passage differently. Rashi, on this statement that so too for prayer, says like this: "Im mehalech adam bederach, uba es lalun lizpalel." You're traveling, and it's getting late, and you're like, you know what? Here's an inn by the side of the road. I'm going to stop here to go to sleep for the night, and I'm going to say Mariv when I get there. Im yesh beis haknesses lefanav berachok arba milin, holech lizpalel sham v'lan sham. If you could keep going up to 4 mils and find a synagogue in which to pray, then you may not stop by that roadside inn. You got to keep going another 4 miles in order to go to the synagogue, to daven Maariv in the synagogue. But if it's more than 4 miles away, and I should also add for a source we're going to see later, if it's behind you, you only have to go 1 mile back, because that's out of your way. So we're not going to make you go 4 miles back, but you still have to go up to 1 mile backwards to go to a synagogue, according to Rashi, or to find water, according to Rabbi Yochananel. Okay. So what have we seen so far? As we're about to sort of exit from classical rabbinic texts and move into medievals, we've seen the first text, which I believe it was Lynn who said, is sort of internally contradictory. On the one hand, talks about the value of prayer with a community, the value of prayer with a minyan. But on the other hand, talks about major sages who, for whatever reason, had some other competing value, such that they did not pray with a minyan, which would make it seem like this is not an obligation. To the extent that it is an obligation, it seems like it's an obligation because it is a way of improving your prayer experience. That was the first source. The second source, which said that Rabbi Eliezer violated a commandment in order to make a minyan, which makes it seem like it's pretty important to have a minyan. And the third source, which, if you follow Rashi's interpretation, would suggest that there is an obligation to pray, and I want to be careful how I say this, in a synagogue, right? Notice Rashi doesn't actually talk about a minyan. Rashi says, if there's a synagogue within 4 mil, you got to go that far, which, because of the context in which we're learning this, you might have assumed meant, oh, to pray with a minyan. But he actually doesn't say that. And the truth is, how do I know there will be a minyan at the synagogue when I get there? So it's actually possible that what Rashi means is that there's a value in praying, not with a minyan, but in a place that is set aside for prayer, right? And this gets back to some, I think Rhonda was saying before, right? Like, there's a value of place. There are certain places that are set aside and holier because of what we do there. So that's possible. It's also possible he means with a minyan. We'll see later a later authority who reads Rashi that way. But let's notice also that if you don't read like Rashi, if you read it like Rabbi Yochananel, then this source says nothing about prayer with a minyan or a synagogue. Rather, it's about prayer with washing your hands before prayer. So we leave sort of the world of the Talmud with very unclear attitudes towards an obligation in prayer. And I would say, if there were in fact an obligation for Catherine, let's say, who's now on the top of my screen, to pray with a minyan, well, then the Talmud probably should have said that somewhere, right? And it doesn't say that anywhere. It kind of alludes to the value of praying with a minyan without ever saying that, in fact, you have an obligation. The only possible exception is that statement of mitzvah derabim, and whether that is an obligation on each individual or a communal obligation.
How exactly do we conceptualize of a chiyuv that's like on a community as a whole, right? Like, how are we defining community? Who's defining, like, it's kind of that.
So Yes, I think there are a couple of what I mean, you actually even said there's a couple of questions, Hannah, right? One is like, I live in Riverdale, where there are many, many synagogues. Does that mean that each synagogue has its own obligation to make Tefillah B'Tzibur happen? Does it mean that the Riverdale Jewish community, to the extent you can speak of it that way, has an obligation? That is a really valuable question, which I don't think there's a straightforward answer. I think like there's a reason why you're asking that, and it's unclear. And there's another question which also is unclear, but I think we have to take even more seriously because it's going to come up already today, which is, okay, so it's all well and good for me to say that Hannah and Yehudit and Andrea don't have an individual obligation to pray with a minyan, but that if they all live in the same community, their community has an obligation to make prayer with a minyan happen. But if Hannah and Yehudit and Andrea don't go to minyan, then there won't be a minyan, right? So it's a little bit of a slippery thing to talk about a communal obligation rather than an individual obligation, when a communal obligation can only be fulfilled if individuals come together to do that thing together. And that, I think, actually gets us to another way of thinking about what, to the extent that there is an obligation to daven with a minyan, why is there such an obligation, right? One thing we said was that Hannah's prayer will be more mitkabel, it will be more accepted by God if Hannah davens with a minyan. But another thing we could say is, well, if Hannah doesn't daven with a minyan, then there won't be a minyan. And so another way you might say it is that anyone who counts in the minyan is obligated to pray with a minyan. And that means if I want to know who's obligated to daven with a minyan, I have to skip ahead several weeks to what we're going to talk about, who counts in a minyan. And only once I've answered that question can I answer the question of who is obligated to daven in a minyan. So already in terms of framing, I'm going to use Hannah's question as a way to help us sort of think about a framing for today, which is, if there's an obligation to daven with a minyan, it's going to come from one of two places. Either because it makes my prayer better, in which case anyone who's obligated to daven is obligated to daven with a minyan, or it's in order to make sure that we have a minyan, in which case anyone who counts in a minyan is obligated to daven with a minyan, right? But the directionality goes that way, not the other way. I couldn't say, oh, you, Andrea, don't count in a minyan because you're not obligated to daven with a minyan. That doesn't make sense, because the obligation to daven in a minyan would devolve from the counting in a minyan, not the other way around.
So if the commandment is a communal one to create the conditions for a minyan to exist, referencing back some of the explanation from last week, using the example of familial obligations, child rearing, could not one also be considered as participating in the communal commandment to create communal davening if they are, say, staying at home with children to enable one person to go participate?
Great. I mean, here it's even more extreme than with davening in general, right? In davening in general, we saw the B'nai Tzion say, oh, even though we make you daven nowadays, even if you're distracted, there are certain kinds of distractions, specifically child rearing, that are so powerful that that actually exempts you from prayer. Here we're going to see that actually, I mean, we've already seen, right? If even if you follow Rashi, that there's an obligation. Rashi seems to think there's an obligation to pray either in synagogue or with a minyan. But even that is limited, right? I'm not going to make you go 10 miles to find a synagogue, right? If you're traveling and there's a synagogue 10 miles ahead, well, then you can stop at the roadside inn and not daven in the synagogue. So it's clearly because it's dependent on others. I'm not fully in control of whether I fulfill this obligation or not, if it's an obligation. We're going to be even more expansive in the exemptions that we allow, right? Someone who lives in Iowa City, Iowa, I'm just using the example because it's a place I know, where there is a minyan on Shabbos, but not during the week, like you're not held accountable for not davening with a minyan every day, but you would be held accountable on Shabbos morning, let's say. And if you live in Cedar Falls, Iowa, a different place I know, where there's not even a minyan on Shabbos, then you would be exempt from this mitzvah even on Shabbos. So it's going to have a more expansive range of exemptions than the obligation to pray in general. Okay, so now let's turn to the medieval period and see how this plays out. And we'll start with the Rambam, an author who tends to be one of the clearest codifiers in the medieval period. The Rambam says like this: Tefillat HaTzibur Nishmas Tamid. Communal prayer is always heard. And we already saw where he's getting that from, that passage that this is a time of desire for God. V'afilu hayu behen chotim, ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu mo'es bi'tfilasan shel rabim. even if you are in a congregation where there are transgressors. I know most of you davening communities that are full of only tzaddikim, but even for those small number of us who pray in communities that have some sinners among them, that was a joke, but apparently not a very good one. Even for those of us who pray in synagogues that have some sinners among them, God will not reject the prayer of the many, that exact language that we saw lifted out of the Midrash on the book of Job. Lefichach, tzarich adam l'shatef atzmo im hatzibur. Therefore, why? Because of what I just said. Therefore, a person must connect themselves to the community. V'lo yispalel b'yachid, kol zman she'achol yispalel im hatzibur. And you should not daven on your own whenever you could daven with a minyan. And the person should always get up early and stay late to pray at synagogue, because a person's prayer is only heard in the synagogue. A person's prayer is only consistently heard in the synagogue. Notice he sort of switched his language there, by the way, from with the community and with the minyan to in the synagogue. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but worth thinking about. The whole Mishi Yeshlo Beis HaKnesses Be'iro of Eilu Mispalel Bo Imatzibor Nikra Shachin Ra. And anyone who has a synagogue in your community and doesn't pray there, you are a bad neighbor. So nothing new here. This is just the Rambam sort of codifying what we've seen. But I want to point out that even as he's codifying it, he is not saying Chayiv, right? Obligated. He's not saying Chayiv Adam Mispalel Ima Minyan, but rather, here's why you should connect yourself. Right? He doesn't say tzarich, right? So there is language that you could read here as obligation language, but it's not the Rambam's normal, straightforward language of you got to do this, you got to not do that. That was the first halacha in chapter 8 of the Laws of Prayer. We're skipping now to halacha number 3. He says, "Beis hamidrash gadol mebeis hakneses." The study hall is greater than the synagogue. "V'chachamim gedolim." Even though great sages had many synagogues in their communities, they would pray where they davened, right? That is exactly the story we saw in the Talmud of Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi, right? Better to daven where you learn than where people in general pray. But there's one line left that I haven't read yet. V'hushis palel sham tilas etzibor. And that is provided that you're praying communal prayer there and not just on your own. So the Rambam, even though this is a code of law and not a commentary on the Talmud, he actually is offering an interpretation, like Lynn was doing earlier, I think it was Lynn, saying that story of Rabbi Yamin Rabbi Yossi, that sounded like it contradicted the first half, right? The first half was all about how important communal prayer is. And then we were told, well, Rabbi Yamin Rabbi Yossi, they didn't actually participate in communal prayer ever. Well, the Rambam says, no, it just didn't tell us that, right? But really, they would gather a minyan where they were learning, and that's what was going on. Now, I already showed my hand and told you, I don't think that's pshat of that Talmudic passage, right? Lynn sort of went through the exercise for us of, well, there's a contradiction here, so I'd have to add into what it's telling me about Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, say, oh, maybe there was a minyan there, but it's weird that it doesn't tell me that. And I didn't bring this source, but the Rosh, another medieval authority, he actually brings the story of Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi and does not have this limitation there. So it's clear that different medieval authorities would disagree, like Lynn herself, about how to read that story. And the Rambam seems to fall more on the side of, yeah, it is at least valuable, and maybe even he's saying it's an obligation to pray with a minyan. If so, why? Because that's where your prayer will be better received. And if that's the case, then there's no reason to think that this would be a gendered obligation. Because if women are obligated to pray, as we learned last week, then they too should be obligated to pray in as good a way as possible, which would mean praying with a minyan. And let's keep going on to an even more explicit statement. This is the Maharil, a very important medieval authority in what we now call Germany and Ashkenaz. And this is not, as you see from the title here, it's not about the laws of prayer, but the laws of making an Eruv, different kinds of Eruv. And he's talking here about an Eruv Tzchumen, which I'll quickly explain what it is. If you don't understand my quick explanation, you can shoot me an email or stick around at 2 and follow up. It's not essential, but an Eruv Tzchumen is basically, you're only allowed to go a certain distance on Shabbos beyond the city limits to walk, even if you're not carrying anything, but you still may not walk more than 2,000 cubits beyond the city limits. But you can make an Eruv Tzchumen, which again, I can explain the details here, but is a way of saying, oh, I'm actually starting Shabbos in this place where I'm not literally starting Shabbos. And that allows me to extend how far I can walk on Shabbos. Again, if you don't understand the details, it's not important. What is important is that the Mishnah says, and this is how he begins, Tnan is taught in the Mishnah, Ein manichin erev tumin rak lismoch alav leilech ledavar mitzvah. Right? One may not do this erev tumin thing unless you're doing it for a mitzvah. Right? I may not, if I just want to like, you know, go to see a friend on Shabbos who lives too far away, I may not do an erev tumin for that. But it has to be for a mitzvah, like kagon lebeis ha'avel or lebeis ha'mishnah. If I am going to a shiva house, I'm going to pay a shiva call. Wouldn't be a shiva call on Shabbos, but I'm going to comfort mourners on Shabbos, or I am going to a wedding celebration, shiva brachos on Shabbos. For that, I'm allowed to make an erev tumin because those are mitzvahs that I'm fulfilling. Amar Ma'ari Segel, the Ma'aril said, the lo ra'a b'shum posek shemutr la'arev tumin le'lech le'beis ha'knesses k'nei b'zbalel v'asara. Right? The Ma'aril said, I never saw anyone who allowed an erev tumin to go double with a minion. If the nearest minion to you is more than 2,000 cubits beyond the city limits, says the Ma'aril, no one allows that. Rak b'smak u'b'sefer aguda. Well, other than these two guys, there actually are two authorities who permit it. For me to put an Erev Tumen down to go daven with a minion, but everyone else, is the Ma'aril, does not allow it. Amar le Rabbeinu Ravika. So this other rabbi says the Ma'aril, the lo yei pachos mebeis ha'mishta, right? Going to daven with a minion should be at least as mitzvahic as going to Shavuot brachos, going to a wedding celebration. Amar le, Ma'aril says, Amar le Rav, the Ma'aril says back to him, he's palel be'asara, ain't a kol kach mitzvah. To daven with 10, that's not such a mitzvah. The achol echaven tfilas beveso, because you can have proper kavana in your house. You can have proper intention, you're davening in your house. The lo eshkan eshari tzricho chachamim lispalel ba'asar. Because we don't actually find that the sages of the Talmud ever obligated anyone to pray with 10. So the Ma'aril comes along and says, there's no mitzvah to daven with 10. It's not, at first he says, it's not such a mitzvah. And he says, we don't find any statement of obligation anywhere in the Talmud. And another medieval authority, the Tashbetz, says it even more clearly. He says like this, Shechovas tziborhi lis palel be'asara. There is a communal obligation to pray with 10. Right? Going back to that notion that we talked about before, that Hannah asked a follow-up question about aval, but im yesh sham yoser mi'asara, if there are more than 10, kol achad yechol lomar lo, each person can say to themselves, "Valo yesh asar chutz mimeni? Are there not 10 without me?" V'im ken harei yecholi shemet milavo etzlacha bosasha. And if that's the case, then I can avoid going. I can refrain from going to the minyan at that time. In other words, if you're at shul and you need to go to, well, restroom is a bad example because that's an overriding value. But like you're at shul, you're getting bored and you want to go to the Kiddush Club. I know none of you would ever go to the Kiddush Club during davening, but hypothetically, right? You want to go to the Kiddush Club. If there's a minion without you, at least on the axis of a minion, davening the minion, that would be allowed, right? As long as you're not the 10th and they need you for the minion, says the Tashbetz, since it's a communal obligation, not an individual one, you're allowed to leave. I'm going to stop the screen share here and take questions because we just went through a whole chunk of stuff. We went through the Rambam talking about it is one should try when one needs to daven with a minion to make your prayer more heard, and his sort of limitation of Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi. We saw the Ma'aril saying that there's no mitzvah daven with 10, and we saw the Tashbetz saying not only is there that it's a communal obligation, but therefore you are allowed to actually walk out of the minion as long as there's still a minion without you.
Well, this is a possibly somewhat unusual situation. My congregation typically has two and sometimes three services going. We have a main conservative service and Orthodox minion and a more by the book traditional egalitarian minion. And sometimes, some weeks, we are short with all of them, but especially the second two. So how do you square the issue if you are counted in any of those minyanim of leaving one minyan to help make the minion for another?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is, I think classical sources are going to lean in the direction of you can't leave a minion if doing so will cause that minion not to be a minion. even if it's to go make another minion have a minion. But what I think the Tashbetz would say unquestionably is, if I'm in a minion with 15 people and there's another minion with 9, I can, and maybe even I should, leave and go help that minion make a minion. I mean, we, you know, that gets into other questions of like, does the person in question think that all 3 minionim are valid? And, you know, I don't know what the internal politics of your synagogue are, so we can talk about that offline. But in terms of like, if I'm leaving one minion that has plenty to help another minion make their minion, like, yeah, actually, that seems like that would be a case where actually you probably should leave the minion. And that's precisely because, well, I guess in that case, it's even better because you're going from one minion to another minion. So either way, you're going to be fine in that case.
So the Maharil actually says there's no obligation in the sages to pray with a minion?
Because there isn't, right? You can go through the Talmud and it'll say you have to daven shacharis by either the 4th hour of the day or the 6th hour of the day. You will not find where it says you've got to daven with a minion. You will find what we already saw, which is if you daven with a minion, it's going to be much better. And if you take prayer seriously, then isn't that kind of an obligation? Because if I'm obligated to pray and my prayer is better with a minion, then I should pray with a minion. But is it a formal obligation? Hard to say, right? And he does say that there's a communal obligation, right? Because otherwise, there would never be Torah reading. There would never be Kaddish and Kedushah and Baruch Hu. But there's not, a strictly speaking, a technical obligation for Rhonda specifically, as opposed to for Rhonda's community to have a minion.
My question is, can you clarify the mitzvah derabim? What, I mean, like an elevator pitch, what does it mean? I mean, I know what the Oraita, the Baruch, but derabim, what does it mean?
Great. I can only clarify it by giving 2 possibilities and tell you which one I prefer, but not by telling you unambiguously that that's what it means. The 2 possibilities are, it means many people have a chance to fulfill a mitzvah, and that's, therefore it's mitzvah dirabim, it's a mitzvah for many people, or it's like what the Maharil says here about a communal obligation, which is to say, it's not that 10 people each fulfill a mitzvah, but rather the community fulfills a mitzvah as a community. Those are 2 possibilities. I think the latter reading is the stronger reading, but I can't say unambiguously that that's correct and the other one is wrong.
Yeah, I was just thinking about Brachot 3a and, you know, going to the Korban to pray. And that's just that simple that, you know, Elijah never says to the rabbi, why did you go to get for a minion? He just says, why did you pray there? You know, that, you know, it's individual prayer is completely within our behavior and allowance, and it's not required to go find a minion to daven with.
Fantastic. I'll just make sure everyone's on the same page with that. There is a passage in Tractate Brachot where Elijah finds someone, I forget who it is, davening in the ruins of a synagogue, if I remember correctly, right? And he says, why are you davening here? This is a dangerous place to pray.
It's a korban, it's Yerushalayim, so it's considered to be the Beit HaMikdash or something.
Uh-huh. And the response is, why are you praying here? This is a dangerous place to pray. And like a medieval authority, the Rishonim, one of the things that is most impressive about them is when they point out not what's in the Talmud, but what's lacking in the Talmud. And Josh does exactly that here. He says, it doesn't say, why aren't you praying with a minion? And clearly he could have been praying with a minion. So that also is another source that would suggest there's no formal obligation to pray with a minion in Talmudic sources.
So having not learned that much Gemara, like, inside, I'm struck by the fact that, like, the support texts are all from, like, stories.
Yeah.
And not even from, like, the original 5. Like, they're going pretty far into the weeds to find support texts for these things.
Yes. So we will see in the next source, which we'll look at next week. It doesn't make sense to start it now. A group of later authorities who do derive this obligation from that obscure passage of Psachim about going for meal, which is not a story. But you're right. The vast majority of texts that deal with this are coming out of these narratives. And that is, like, you know, it is valuable to sort of blur the line between law and narrative, because a lot of scholars have shown how that's actually a problematic division. And very often the line between those 2 things, between law and narrative, between halacha and agada, is less black and white than people think of it as being. That said, if a legal topic is coming out entirely from Talmudic stories, and not just stories, but sort of aphorisms, right? Sort of pithy sayings, and not from clearly legally statements in the form of, with a legal format, that tells you something, right? And I think Rachel is exactly right that this hints at the idea that, like, this is a theological notion, not a halakhic notion. that doesn't make it any less important, right? Like, I will be honest, I'm very bad at davening with a minyan when I'm not at work. I'm lucky that at work I have a minyan. But when I'm at home, I'm not great about getting to a minyan. And I'm not proud of that, right? Like, I should be striving to pray with a minyan three times a day. Does that mean that I'm technically obligated such that that has halakhic relevance for other halakhic topics? No, not necessarily. So I think that's where we're leaving things this week. You know, we've got that mitzvah derabim in the Talmud, which maybe hints at a possibility of an obligation to pray with a minyan. We've got the Rambam, who I think is pushing us in that direction, maybe even stating it, but not as clearly as he normally would. We will see next week a group from the Shulchan Aruch and later that do come closer and in one case explicitly state an obligation to daven with a minyan unambiguously. So that's where we'll be going next week.